Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%. If this is the first time you're tuning in, a quick overview. This podcast is all about creative roles and opportunities, and born out of the statistic I heard at the Creative Equals Create Your Future event in May 2018, which was that only 11% of women are creative directors within the media industry. As an artist and creative director myself, I felt compelled to take action to do something that pushes that percentage a lot higher. It occurred to me when thinking about what that action could be, is that there's a lot of careers that I have absolutely no idea what they are and what skills they require. So the possibility to inhabit or inspire to have those roles can never eventuate. And that is even before entering the battleground of opportunity. As I'm super interested in how others shape their creativity, I'll be chatting to a range of women over the series, exploring their careers and their creative lives, in the aim to expand the knowledge of the vast number of options available for pursuing a creative career, in addition to shedding some light on what others do. Episode 9, I'm joined by two design makers, educators and advocates, and the founders of Graphic Design And, Rebecca Wright and Lucian Roberts. Rebecca Wright is Programme Director of Graphic Communication Design at Central St Martin's University of Arts London. Her writing on design and design education has been published in numerous books and journals, and she has lectured, consulted and spoken at events on all things design, extensively in the UK and abroad. Lucian Roberts is a graphic designer, design writer and educator. She's also the founder and director of design studio Lucian Roberts Plus. Her work extends into many strands, 2 and 3D exhibition design, books, branding and corporate identity. She has worked with organisations such as the Wellcome Trust, Science and Media Museum and the Tower of London. And she was topographer in residence this year at the Hofmitz-Milken Centre for Topography in Los Angeles Art Centre College of Design. In 2011, Rebecca and Lucien formed Graphic Design And, a publishing house which explores how graphic design informs, connects, and its value, whilst challenging the perceptions about what and who graphic design is for. Graphic Design And takes many shapes, exhibitions, books, talks, and events, and has won a number of design awards. Recent works include Graphic Design and Health, which took form in an exhibition, Can Graphic Design Save Your Life?, at the Wellcome Trust London in 2017. And was accompanied by a book of the same title. The work expanded how vital visual design is within health communication. Earlier this year, they produced a book and exhibition in collaboration with London's Design Museum titled Hope to Nope, Graphics and Politics, 2008 to 2018, looking at the role of graphic design within the political landscape across the globe over the last decade, charting campaigns to backlash and everything in between. Their work is thought-provoking, intelligent, joyous, and can fill a void you didn't even know needed filling, graphic design and religion being a good example. Rebecca and Lucian, it is with great delight to welcome you both to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what's fantastic is Rena Chung, senior designer, who was a guest on episode 6, requested that I speak to you both, and here you are. So I'm wondering if we can start off maybe looking at both your careers individually. Lucian, can I ask you what a graphic designer is?
I have to answer it by going back a few stages because I come from a design family. My dad was a typographer, my mum was an illustrator. So it's not a big surprise that I would end up doing this. They were also quite political, so it's also not a surprise that was my other interest. So I've always tied graphic design to politics loosely, not necessarily with a capital P, but, you know. So when I went off, I went to Central, and I was primarily interested in the treatment of words as well. So typography was mostly my thing, and really I was interested in the impact that how you depict something visually could have on how you understand it and interpret it. And I was only really interested in doing work that was for some sort of cause that I believed in. But that's very broad.
Yeah.
But you know, when I left college, I worked for a feminist publisher, the Women's Press, very near here actually, in Great Sutton Street they were, which was a fantastic introduction to that world, because I met wonderful, wonderful women, angry women, passionate women, dedicated women, who proved they could make a difference. And they kind of took me with them, you know. A lot of them left and worked, one of them ended up working, well, a colleague of a colleague ended up working for Tony Blair.
Okay.
And then we ended up working for Tony Black, you know, so it was a wonderful beginning, but it's quite a kind of, it was a very purposeful decision, if you mm-hmm. like, to, and I think it's much harder to work in that way now, which I'm mm-hmm. sure we can talk about later. So there was that, and then I studied English literature after I'd been at art school, so
okay.
because I love reading and writing, yeah. and so books became a thing, the treatment uh-huh. of books as well. And then the exhibition side of things, which we do a lot of now, probably is traceable back to my one act of rebellion with my parents was that I went to drama school before I went to art school.
Okay.
And studied stage management. And so theatre and exhibition okay. design is quite a relationship, I think.
So you've got theatre, stage, then design, and then
English,
literature.
Yeah.
Wow, what a combination.
Actually, in terms of drama school, it's great that I could put it to good use because yeah. It was a fantastic experience being there, and we worked very long hours, often at night, which I still do.
Uh-huh.
But I was unhappy. I knew it wasn't really my thing in the uh-huh. end. But in the end, it has fed back okay. into the work, which has been great.
Okay. So, Rebecca, as a design educator, can you talk through what your role encompasses?
So I'm Programme Director of Graphic Communication Design at Central St Martin's, mm-hmm. and I've been in this role, I think this is my seventh year maybe, and now I feel like I'm more of an overseer because I'm not teaching as much. I started off teaching nearly 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and that was a really immediately fulfilling, exciting, challenging thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think partly because I never really knew what I wanted to do. And I talk to students sometimes about how finding where your feet need to be in relation to where your head is
yeah.
is not often a straight line, and I'm definitely a crooked person. So I've had my feet, I studied fine art
uh-huh.
before moving across to graphic design, and then did illustration, that was my MA, and then got into teaching at the same time as trying to freelance as an illustrator
yeah.
but I quite quickly realized that wasn't really for me.
Uh-huh.
And I think education became a really important part of questioning what the discipline was and what it could be, but also was a way of me continuing learning.
Uh-huh.
And it still is. So I've been through various kind of teaching roles, and I was course leader of graphic design at Kingston University before moving to Central St Martin's. And now the most mundane bits of my job are the bureaucracy. The best bits okay. of my job are being able to look at what the strategic and academic direction of the programme is. And the programme has 600 students in it. There are around 500 undergrads and around 100 postgrads. And then we have PhD students as well. So it's truly one of those kind of unfathomable communities of designers and potential designers. They're very international. So over 2/3 of our programme come from outside of the UK. And that also means that I'm constantly having to rethink assumptions about what clear graphic communication might be and what graphic design culturally might mean to different students.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it stops you being in this position of thinking that you're the expert. Actually, the students are as much experts as us, just in different things. So I love what I do. It can be a fairly exhausting job, but it is kind of consistently thrilling
mm-hmm.
as well. So I guess Lucy and I are interesting because in a way our histories, Lucy, while having a very clear position within the industry and it being political, your work with a small p, I come from image really predominantly. That's
mm-hmm.
what I did my MA in, and I haven't spent that long in the industry
mm-hmm.
really. I've been in education. I quite quickly moved from being a visiting lecturer to being a fractional member of the of staff and then into a full-time role. And I think it's those different perspectives that actually have been really important in terms of how we work, because we share, I think, philosophical approaches and the same things matter to us, but we have really different
mm.
experiences and expertise.
Mm-hmm. Which leads nicely on to talking about how graphic design and is another strand on top of your existing roles, yours in the industry, yours is within education. So how do you individually and collectively manage that?
Actually, we've had some quite heartfelt conversations about this because obviously my time's more flexible. Mm-hmm. So in all honesty, I probably do a bit more of it, really.
Definitely. And actually, Lucy project manages me, I would say. So some of that stage management experience definitely comes in to how this works. And Lucy does do more. And I think what it every project is a different negotiation in a way, and that's what has been successful, but it's also what makes this challenging and frustrating at points, because we don't have the same routines or rhythms to how we work at all, and where we find the time that we can have in common and where we can delegate or just make it work. And that is part of what's interesting. I mean, we've spoken before about how, on the one hand, this wouldn't happen without our friendship, and the friendship is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are moments where that's really hard because you're wanting to say, well, why the hell haven't you done this? That's usually Lucy to me. or I need this by 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, or whatever it is. And that's harder when you're friends, because some of those kind of colder kind of business professional decisions are wrapped up in that.
But also, I know doing the two exhibitions, because we've done loads of exhibition work, suddenly, you know, with the books, they're self-initiated things. They can take as long as we need them to take, although actually I think there's a financial imperative, obviously, to get them out there. But with the exhibitions, once you're tied up to an institution, then that's it. Yeah. I mean, they're a client and you've got to get on with it.
Yeah.
And the first one, because I'd done quite a lot of work for the Welcome before anyway, so we had a sort of established relationship. And also you had some time, you could give more time to it then, and that worked. That was brilliant, actually. It was a kind of dream scenario for me because Becky was around more. And
so I was on maternity leave.
Okay.
So we had this.
It's not really on a break.
No, but it's more dialogue. It's easier. I could phone up and she'd answer the phone. Yeah. You know, that was great.
it's on top of.
Precisely. Yeah, yeah. I think for both of us, this is on top of what we do.
Yeah.
And you know, Lucy, when you're involved in projects where they're client-driven projects, then obviously that's paid work. And for graphic design and for Lucy and I, we don't take any money from that. Mm-hmm. So our time is free. Mm-hmm. But of course, I'm on a full-time salary from Central St Martins, with the understanding that part of what I need to do to fulfil my contract is have my practice. But the reality of the full-timeness of education is that the job doesn't fit in 5 days a week, let alone less. And it's the same with Lucy with client projects, but the rhythms kind of work differently. And the great thing about being on maternity leave was just Lucy knew where I was and I was kind of available, but also my head, of course, it was focused on having my daughter and being with her, but I had space in my head to be thinking and working in a different way.
Whereas I think when Hope to Nope happened, again, Design Museum, we'd worked with them a lot before, but you were back at the helm at CSM then, and so we brought in my colleague Dave to co-curate, because and actually it was perfect because it's an area of expertise for him too. So, but I know there were frustrations for you because you couldn't be as involved as you were with Save Your Life. So it's a sort of, but in the end, we have to work with it within the framework that we have.
And I think we're quite pragmatic in that way, because the thing that drives us is getting things out there.
Yeah.
And it would be really easy to not accomplish these projects because we're waiting for the right moment, or we're saying it has to be us two driving it in equal ways. And actually it doesn't happen. And I think, you know, again, this is where I think our personalities are quite interesting, because we're both used to leading in our other jobs. And then when we come together, we have these interesting things where we talk about this sometimes and saying, how do we get this to work? Because we're both quite mouthy and we're both quite stubborn in some ways and we're both opinionated. But actually, I think somehow we work together in a way that we listen and we realise that graphic design and is stronger for being both of our voices.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that we've only recently been upfront about saying that we're advocating for our subject because we didn't even fully appreciate that's what we were. It's implicit, but we hadn't made it explicit. And that's very useful because now it's a sort of benchmark, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we'll say, well, does this do that job? Mm-hmm. Does this project foreground what graphic design can do without being about graphic design necessarily in a sort of showcasey way? And so, because actually all the projects have an educational value. That's
absolutely,
you know. Yeah. But I don't think we'd foregrounded it before, as I think now we're thinking about it more in that way, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. So maybe we can talk about how you kind of came together back, you know, pre-2011, before graphic design and became an official entity.
Lucy's looking at me because it was through an ex-boyfriend of mine and the relationship ended. But Lucy and I continued. And actually, I think so the other thing that's interesting about us is that we are almost exactly
10 years
apart in age.
Okay.
By 3 days,
mm-hmm. yes. And somehow the conversations that we started having when we met kind of as friends established that there was something, I would say almost sisterly to start off with. There was a really lovely kind of connection that we had. And then Lucy was working on books and you were the first person to ask me to write something, actually. So I'd always kind of been quite happy talking, but hadn't written, to be published. And it was through those long conversations around writing biographies and writing additional texts for your books that we just kind of realised there was something a bit special about the connection that we had. And then we were commissioned by Lawrence King to write a book called Design Diaries, which was a book on the creative process behind graphic design. And it actually, even that was kind of about demystifying something. So demystifying the creative process, which has stayed with us as something that each of our projects tries to kind of do.
Yeah.
But it was as a result of that book and going to interview Experimental Jet Set in Amsterdam and sitting in the cafe of the Stedelijk.
When it was in that other building.
In the postal building,
yeah,
was
that's
it?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a really rainy day.
Yeah.
And we sat there steaming, saying, What is it that we're enjoying about this? And we realised the thing that was interesting was not really the graphic design. It was hearing all of the contributors that we were interviewing talking about what their projects were about. And that wasn't the graphic design. It was every other discipline and subject. And then we also had that conversation about saying, I think we went to the bookshop and we said, all these graphic design books are graphic designers writing books for other graphic designers. Then it felt really self-congratulatory.
But also it's a bit sad.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
There are lots of showcase books out there and we consume them. I love them too.
Yes, we love them. Yeah.
But it's almost as if we've come to terms with the idea that we just do our thing. Mm-hmm. We're a little bunch of nerdy obsessives about it. Nobody else cares. And we'll just publish things for other graphic design, you know, and that's it. Because we accept that we're on the edges here really, and you know. We thought, well, we're not. This is such an important activity. Uh-huh. It completely shapes the
experience. And also, if graphic design is something that everybody consumes, which we do, it is everywhere, and it is in such a fundamental way linked to how we live our lives, why aren't the books that are accessible to non-designers, and why aren't we talking about, in a way, the unglamorous, unshowcasey bit, which is what graphic design does. Mm-hmm. And that felt like, it just felt like there was a gap.
Yeah.
So straight away, we started thinking, when we talked about there being other subjects, one of the things that we straight away liked was that this could be a lifetime's project.
Yes.
It was this thing of, we're never going to have covered every subject. Yeah. So that felt like a really, that was, again, one of those moments where we looked at each other and went, great, this is the challenge yes. that we can meet.
So a practical question, and you kind of alluded to it before when you were saying that both of you kind of don't take any kind of income from the project. Mm. So how do you get things off the ground? How do you get funding? How does it kind of, you know, to publish a book costs money, to have an exhibition? How does that all work? What's the steps you take?
The thing is, the first book that we did was printed in a bog standard paperback way, which is very cheap. It's one colour. And actually that sort of liberated us because that book was very successful. So it reprinted. And about 500 copies were bought by the ISTD for all their members.
Yeah.
So that was fantastic. So we got a little bit, a pot of money from that. I put some money in at the beginning, which is still in there, really. You've put some money in a more ongoing kind of way.
And we've got we got a little bit of funding from Kingston University initially. So there's some academic funding that goes in from time to time. But actually, one of the other things that is tricky is, on the whole, the books make enough to pay to back do and then create that little pot to be able to start to build the next project. But recently, a couple of decisions, with hindsight, have tied up some of the money that we've had. Yeah. And I think this is the thing, we're not business people in this sense. We know our businesses, education and design, but when it comes to publishing, we are still learning as we go. And I think the other thing we've realised with our books is that we are building quite a loyal and a really important readership among designers, but each of our books is about another discipline, and we're always considering that secondary audience or that other audience, but we're having to find new ways of reaching them with each book because they're a different audience. And that means that our sales are pretty unpredictable from title to title, so it's precarious.
Yeah, it is. And I think what we've sort of agreed is we're not going to do reprints anymore.
Yeah,
because that ties up a lot of money.
Okay.
And they trickle out. Yeah. But you need the money to do the next project. And it's interesting that with page one, it's probably an okay decision, but broadly, I think it's just not worth it because it creatively it stops you, and that's not what we're interested in. And even though, so Looking Good, for example, the book about the nun's habit, was very successful, and they've all gone, and loads of people have said, "Are you going to reprint it?" And the answer is no, because we've done it.
Yeah.
And although we know there's an interest, in the end, you'd have 1,000 books or whatever sitting on a shelf every 2 years, gradually going out the door. That's not helpful to us. But you know, it's taken a while to fully
And also perhaps for us to accept that success is selling out of a print run.
Yeah.
And that we don't need to keep feeding that feel good of people want this book by reprinting. And actually for us, the more important thing is moving on to the next project.
Yes.
And actually with Can Graphic Design Save Your Life, there was a discussion at one point about whether we would take on touring that show. And actually it was a pretty easy decision for us in the end to say, we don't want the next few years of our life to be working on that project. What we want to do is work on the next project. That's the driver now, isn't it?
I was just thinking more about the practical steps as well of that. You know, if someone's thinking about starting a book or, you know, getting a collective together, what is the steps? Because, you know, the money is a bit of a stop sometimes to
the
step
thing is
over.
We applied to the Arts Council for page one, didn't we? And we didn't get the money. No. And in the end, at the time, it was I could put the money in. So you just think, why are we waiting for funding? Really? And I mean, we will be applying. We have applied for something recently, actually, which we haven't heard about yet. So we are applying for funding. Mm-hmm. But it's unfortunately, particularly in this current climate, I think, it can just knock it on the head. Yeah. And also filling in the forms is so laborious.
Oh my God.
I mean, and I think there's an element of speculating. You know, if you've got some money to put in, it doesn't necessarily take a huge amount to get a project off the ground. One of the things that we were really amazed by, I think, with page one was how many of the contributors that we approached said yes. You know, we thought I think we were quite anxious about a project that involved 70 different people accepting a brief, which was unpaid. We did give them copies of the book, and we were quite upfront about the fact that we couldn't pay them, but we would give them 5 copies of the book each. And but people said yes. And I think in terms of encouraging other people who have ideas out there, we would say, if you've got the energy and the time and you've got enough money to get something started, it's only by doing it that you're going to know. And actually, as soon as we had page one, we had a product, an outcome that allowed us to build the next projects, because we had something we could go to other contributors or the experts that we collaborated with on future books and say, here's the evidence of what we're doing, here's what we created, here's the press, here's what we, you know, our ambition is. And so we've managed to kind of use each project to build the next project. And you do make sacrifices, that's with perhaps not too great a word, but in terms of time and money and life in order to make these things happen. But I think if you really want to do it, as Lucy says, you can't wait for things to come through. There's too much there's too much frustration there. And just thinking of you and your commercial work, one of the early conversations was also how you were really desperate to do some work which didn't involve a client. You know, the freedom that gives is worth a lot as well.
Can we talk about a couple of projects? You've been mentioning page one, so maybe we should talk about that a little bit. And also one of my favourites, as I've kind of mentioned in the intro, is I do love the design and religion. So maybe a little bit about that.
Well, Looking Good, which is the book about the nun's habit, came about partly because I went to a convent, primary school, and it wasn't horrible, it was brilliant, and my nuns were brilliant. And it meant that whenever I'd go on holiday, particularly, you know, Italy, for example, or, you'd see all these women in their different coloured habits, and I think, what does that colour mean? And then
we had a little bit of a running joke about a spotter's guide to nuns. I didn't grow up a Catholic, but I was part of the C of E in quite a loose, you know, way that C of E, Church of England, church going is, but it meant that there were frames of reference that we shared that not many of our friends did. And so it was a little bit of an in-joke. And I think one of the things with starting your own publishing company that we realised early on was that we wanted to do projects that would sell, that would have an audience, but we also needed to do projects that nobody else would publish, that as just your moment to say, do you know what, if we went to a publisher and said we'd like to do a book on what nuns wear for graphic designers or using graphic design, I don't think there would be a publisher in the world that would have taken that up. So we'd reached a point where we produced enough books to know that we would work on this, that it was a project we could potentially fund. We found a theologian and a graphic artist, and we started work, but it was a labour of love. It took a long time, and we did keep asking, how is this a graphic design and book? Where's the graphic design in this? And really, many nuns are enclosed, so they're not actually out in the communities and aren't visible by the public. And so when Veronica, our theologian, was researching this, what came back out of that research was that there were lots of habits that weren't recorded visually. And it struck us that one of the things that graphic design and illustration can do in quite a unique way is create a record of something that isn't out in the public realm. And we became kind of, it was quite poignant, wasn't it? Realising that in many ways the book was starting to document something that was passing, that perhaps, well, and in fact, absolutely did not exist, that there's no other place where this body of knowledge and research exists. It was a really unique kind of research project. But Lucy and I spent a lot of time writing and rewriting and trying to find the tone of voice that was appropriate, where you could get across things like Vatican II and other really kind of important specific knowledge and contextual historical information in a way that was accessible and understandable, and that allowed the stories about kind of feminist history, social history, the history of nursing, you know, all these amazing stories that are told through the nun's habit.
The habit is basically it's a kit of parts, you know, which is perfect for graphic designers, of course. And so decoding it, which is what we were trying to do, made that very clear. So you have image after image after image that are very simple sort of abstracted versions, actually, of the habit that show how you could map one onto the other, because and what's similar and what isn't. And it became very, visually, it's very delightful.
So can I quickly talk about page one, just because we talked about it quite a bit before?
So this was our first project, and it's kind of an art school project, I guess, but we were interested immediately with that first project in how, if you gave a lot of designers who were diverse in terms of their discipline and their particular specialism the same brief, what would you get back? Mm-hmm. And we came up with this idea of it being the first page of a novel. And then it took us quite a long time to find the right text. But we ended up working out that it was the centenary of Charles Dickens' birth in the year that we published the book. And then we started looking at Dickens' titles. So again, we were looking for a system to help give the project some shape. Mm-hmm. And Great Expectations, the first page of that book, is about the protagonist, Pip, imagining what his dead parents might have been like from the style of the lettering on their tombstones. So he imagines his mother to be a sickly redhead because of the spindly italic in which her name is engraved. So we just felt that was a gift. Mm-hmm. And we created a brief and we sent it out to 70 designers and typographers around the world. A really diverse bunch. We were talking about this earlier, how it's really important for us to, yes, include some names that are recognisable and that people will be interested, you know, they're the hook, but also to represent designers who are not the people who most books already cover and feature, including young designers and emerging designers, but also women, people from different age groups, people from different countries. And so the book was a compendium of those results, the first page of Great Expectations, laid out by 70 designers to try to demonstrate the way in which typography and layout shape or affect the way in which we read, so the voices that we hear in our heads.
Okay, so pedalling back a bit, can you talk about what skills you need to be an excellent graphic designer?
Lucy, you have to answer this first.
But it's changing all the time. And right now, I think it's interesting because graphic design, in the sense that my dad would have understood it, for example, is becoming, it's not irrelevant, but it's less relevant. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's so diverse a field that it's hard, you can't really come up with a set of skills in order, you know. All I can talk about is my field. So as somebody who works a lot within the cultural sector, within exhibitions, somebody who produces books, somebody, you know, it's dedication, obviously. I guess that's common for everybody. Working hard, that's common for everybody. Mm-hmm. Being sort of, there is something about zeitgeist that you just feel it, but I guess that's sort of just tapping into the culture more broadly and trying to be aware of that but not led by it too much. Obviously, as a typographer, I would still say that the thing that sets me apart from someone who uses type but is not a typographer is the interest in language and its depiction and valuing words. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I have a duty to help those words travel further if they're words that I believe in. I'm trying to think what else is. I guess, you know, because I think graphic design is about everything else, and that's exactly what we're, you know, you have to be interested in everything else.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the core.
Yeah.
Curiosity and openness. Yeah. I think one of the things that is a surprise to the potential applicants who come to open days at Central St Martin's mm-hmm. is how much we talk about openness and also empathy mm-hmm. because there are many students and designers out there who have an interest in the aesthetics mm-hmm. and who have basic tools at their disposal to design. And that democratization, in a way, of what graphic design is great. But what you get through really studying or working and being a designer is a way of considering and applying those skills in relation to content. And Lucy's talked about this, you know, language being content if you're a typographer and I think if you're a designer anyway, language is content, but in a very specific way when you're a typographer. But I think for us, this idea that as a graphic designer you're not just making, you're mediating and shaping and manipulating, and so taking the responsibility of that seriously is important. At Central St Martin's on our program mm-hmm. empathy is a really core part of the curriculum. So working with design students on how you design with empathy and for empathy, mm-hmm. because I guess it's become such a complex area, how you control, shape, manipulate messages as a graphic designer. And it's not a neutral act, actually. You might adopt a neutral tone, but it's not a neutral act. And I think Lucy and I would share a real kind of conviction in the fact that we have responsibilities as designers. We're not just the mouthpieces or the messengers for other people's messages. We contribute massively to this environment, and we have a responsibility to question that.
It's becoming more acute. I mean, actually, that's something that I remember when one of my early clients was Breakthrough, which is a breast cancer charity. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time talking to various design journalists about what we were doing, and they were just really not very interested, frankly. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, first of all, it's a woman's issue, but also mm-hmm. I was talking about designer responsibility. And they just, honestly, they were either interested in aesthetics in a very pure sense mm-hmm. or commerce, mm-hmm. you know, and what was it you were bringing in a commercial sense mm-hmm. to, you know, how could you make this product sell more, basically? Mm-hmm. And it was sort of hard. I remember at the time being very disillusioned and angry, actually. And the climate has changed hugely from that point of view, because actually now we can see the results of that, which is what makes me wonder what graphic design is going to become. Mm. Because as a sort of adjunct to selling more stuff that we don't need, and also making people feel, you know, so much of what graphic design, sadly, is employed to do is to make people feel shit about themselves. Mm. You know, if you only have to look at the women's magazines to see how undermining they are, but pretending not to be.
Yeah.
It's just so ghastly. And, you know, we have to make decisions about whether we want to buy into that.
Yeah.
Really. And of course, there's the whole climate change thing as well. So, really, we're at quite an important point now, because I think it's much, much harder now for graphic designers to stand up and talk about their work mm-hmm. as though it's looking at it in a pure sense, devoid of what it's actually doing.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that thing of working in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Certainly when I was a student, when designers came to talk about what they did, it felt like it was in a vacuum. And actually the thing that was pure and the thing that was being shared was the intention. But what was never talked about was how that was then received or what its effect or impact was. Mm. And I think that's what is changing. So it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, of my 600 plus students, they are not all going to turn into designers who want to be responsible designers mm-hmm. and for whom this is part of how they define themselves. You know, I'm ethical and whatever mm-hmm. that means mm-hmm. for the individual. However, what one can do is say, as a designer, you need to be aware of the fact that your work is about sending a message. You need to question what that is and how that happens, and also what the effect is. And this idea of empathy is that really, in the end, the graphic designer is not just putting stuff out there. We make things happen. And if we can begin to think through other people's eyes and put ourselves in other people's shoes, that's going to make for more effective communication, whatever, but it also creates, I think, a different type of citizenship. Mm. And that feels really important. And the skills, the technical skills, of course, are still part of this. Mm-hmm. But actually, a lot of those technical skills are developed through the exposure to not just teaching, but looking at work. And really, it's about how they work in relation to content. So I think the content is and the position in relation to content and impact are things that are just they're undeniable now.
More broadly, I just wonder where the profession's going to go, because so much of it is in support of ideas that actually a lot of us don't really buy into. And I think it's going to become less applauded. That's the thing. Because I think everything's changing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Big question is the amount of stuff that we produce that we don't need. But if we don't produce that stuff and we're not selling it, that's a whole wing of graphic design that's just not needed anymore.
Mm.
It's interesting to me how many of my students are questioning entire services or are looking at not what one would conventionally consider within, sitting comfortably within graphic design, but looking at how one empowers other communities or create communications which get handed over, which in the end removes the designer. Mm-hmm. And technology is a really huge facilitator of those types of kind of innovation. And I think the question about what the discipline is going to be is something that stays, that's part of everything. It's part of all the conversations that we're having. But in education, there's this real question about what skills, what does a curriculum need to be now in order to feel confident that those designers are going to be employable or shaping the discipline of the future? And that's where, I guess, coming back down to these much more transferable human skills feels like it's meaningful, because I think within design education there's a real feeling that those are going to remain as incredibly important attributes and approaches. But Lucy and I still talk about making beautiful things.
Yeah,
I mean, it has to be said that as graphic designers we love making things that are beautiful, and the aesthetics really do count.
But that has an ethical dimension.
Yeah.
But it's not in that, quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the good life. It's not, so actually it's a very, when I wrote Good, which was my book about ethics and graphic design, I went to see Anthony Grayling, philosopher, and that was such a revelatory thing, really, that he talked about, of course, because aesthetics in that sense is part of ethics, that you, by raising somebody's quality of life, that is an ethical endeavour.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not anti-aesthetics at all, but I am wary of it when really bound up with trying to persuade somebody or manipulate somebody to do something they don't need or really want to do.
And we also recognise that we're privileged
to
be where we are in lots of senses. So to be where we are in terms of our careers and our financial position and our kind of employment situation makes graphic design impossible, as we've said. And I think our privilege as what Brexiteers would call the metropolitan elite. And I think we would say, we're London based. We live in a really diverse city. We live somewhere where it's possible to kind of live your politics in a particular way.
Yeah.
And we're financially stable enough to live comfortable lives and not be fearing about really fundamental issues. But with that privilege, I think, comes a sense of responsibility for how you then use this other platform that we have. And that's where, again, for us, so some of the projects that we're thinking of next are really about us trying to work out how we make that a more active part of the projects. And actually thinking about, we think these podcasts are such a great platform for women to hear about other women in design.
Mm-hmm.
And more broadly, graphic design is still such a mono discipline in terms of the people who get the platform generally. And so for us, really trying to extend the range of voices that we will include in our publications, whether they're voices and views we agree with or not, mm-hmm. in terms of content, mm-hmm. but also international diversity, including designers of colour, mm-hmm. including designers of different generations. You know, that's becoming more and more important, I think. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we recognise our privilege, and that it's, you know, it's in a way it's relatively easy for us to be principled and and to talk about responsibility in this way. But actually, that's where the projects come in, as a way to try and live that in a bit. That sounds quite cliche.
So I think I'm acutely aware. I think the same applies to you, even despite the 10-year difference, actually, that we benefited massively from a certain political climate, which, of course, we don't have at the moment.
Mm.
And whilst I'm grieving a lot already for what's lost and what might be lost, it's up to us to try and tackle that in some way, isn't it? But also that you're so much a product of things that are out of your control.
Mm,
you know, sure. I was born in the 60s, mm-hmm. a time of enormous design expansion, mm-hmm. and optimism about what design could do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's affected my whole life. And, you know, I had no control over it.
Yeah.
You know, so how lucky was I? And then how lucky was I to be part of a generation in terms of feminism and then politically that... You know, I still, regardless of what people feel about Tony Blair, the 1997 was that was an extraordinary moment. You know, and I remember all that mourning in 92. So, mm-hmm. you know, and the money that went into education and hospitals and all of those things, you know, I was the beneficiary in many respects, and of public funding more broadly, because, of course, that meant that us as a studio representing all the values that we did,
mm-hmm.
we worked a lot for government, a lot for NGOs, a lot, all that funding's been pulled out now.
Mm.
But, you know, it's still that money that's helping make GDAND happen.
Yeah.
You know, so we were very lucky.
Mm.
But we've got to try and fight to get it back.
I'm sad to say that we're coming to the end of the interview. I could easily talk for the rest of the morning, but I know we've all got things to do. So wondering if I could end something I always end the podcast on, is if you could tell me about a career or job in the creative industries that you know a little about and you'd like to know more about, and I could try and get someone in that role on the podcast, and also a woman within the creative industries that you'd love to hear on Greater Than 11%.
So I was speaking in Warsaw a couple of weeks ago at a conference called Threshold, and one of the speakers was an American woman called Alexander Zygmunt, and she's based in New York,
mm-hmm.
but she used to be the art director of the opinion section of the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
and what really struck me was that she's resigned because she said she was burnt out, and I thought it was amazing to have somebody be honest about that,
mm-hmm.
And also she talked about the heightened atmosphere working there because of Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to hear more about that, because I think this is something where, you know, as a paper, obviously we all know their position, and you can imagine that they feel, well, you can imagine it's a sort of, whilst it must be very energising, it's also terrifying.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you're burnt out anyway, because I think working in the way she was just... I mean, the hours and so on were crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But also I think you add the political climate and the stress levels go up.
And we've spoken before about the difficulty of the work-life balance,
yeah.
and how perhaps for women we're less willing and there's less opportunity for us to talk about some of the clashes, the conflicts that exist around relationships, about caring responsibilities,
mm-hmm. yeah.
In relation to the hours and the culture around graphic design and practicing. And we try to talk about that, and we try to be honest when we are giving lectures or we're talking at festivals about that. But it's really interesting where you find people in the industry prepared to say that as a reason why they're stopping or resigning or moving to a different career. Or a different position. And I think, we think, it's probably there as a reason in quite a few decisions that people make. I mean, we certainly have friends and colleagues who've stepped down from being partners in design studios, for instance, when they have children. Mm-hmm. And I think talking more about that is important.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely. And all the things that are caught up in that sense of failure, you know, letting people down, all that. It's really fascinating. Yeah. Hopefully I can get her on the podcast. And what about a role that you know little about in the creative industries?
Do you know what? This is harder to answer, but I think one of the other things that we've spoken about before is people who either haven't trained as designers, who've then become designers, or people who've trained as designers and then gone on to do something else. Yes. Because there's something around the transferability, but also for graphic design, and what's interesting is the connection of graphic design to these other worlds. Mm-hmm. So actually, I think it would be really interesting to find somebody who has used their graphic design training in a different field.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both for your time today. It's been lovely chatting. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review on Apple Podcasts, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. And also stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haberson, and to Mary Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.